The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. My name is Andy Cahan. I'm director of author events, and I'm very pleased to see all of you here this evening. I'm also excited to welcome two writers who have the temerity to shine a light on some of the darker places of our mental and physical geography. In fact, Russell Banks has not shied from any of the dark places. He has written 12 novels that have featured titanic and domineering fathers, neglected children, misguided terrorists, and with the lost memory of skin. He has given us the fully fleshed story of a homeless young offender whose actions challenge the boundaries of our empathy and judgment. Donald Ray Pollock's name may be unfamiliar at the moment, but I trust it will soon be commonplace. In his short story collection, Knock 'em Stiff, and in his novel, The Devil All the Time, Pollock has created a fictional Ohio town where poverty, prurience, and an unerring knack for making the wrong choice pervade the lives of the town's grim inhabitants. Lust, murder, and zealotry fill the pages, and we cannot and do not want to look away. Banks and Pollock have given us bleak, brave, and vividly human books. I suspect they couldn't help but write them, and we can't but help to want to read them. Please welcome our first speaker, Donald Ray Pollock.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is read a little bit of the prologue from the beginning of the book, and then if I have time, I'll skip around a little bit. Better take my watch off because I tend to get a little carried away. Okay, so here we go. On a dismal morning near the end of a wet October, Arvin Eugene Russell hurried behind his father, Willard, along the edge of a pasture that overlooked a long and rocky holler in southern Ohio called Knock 'em Stiff. Willard was tall and raw-boned, and Arvin had a hard time keeping up with him. The field was overgrown with briar patches and fading clumps of chickweed and thistle, and ground fog, thick as the gray clouds above, reached to the 9-year-old boy's knees. After a few minutes, they veered off into the woods and followed a narrow deer path down the hill until they came to a log lying in a small clearing, the remains of a big red oak that had fallen many years ago. A weathered cross, fitted together out of boards pried from the back of the ramshackle barn behind their farmhouse, leaned a little eastward in the soft ground a few yards below them. Willard eased himself down on the high side of the log and motioned for his son to kneel beside him in the dead, soggy leaves. Unless he had whiskey running through his veins, Willard came to the clearing every morning and evening to talk to God. Arvin didn't know which was worse, the drinking or the praying. As far back as he could remember, it seemed that his father had fought the devil all the time. Arvin shivered a little with the damp, pulled his coat tighter. He wished he were still in bed. Even school, with all its miseries, was better than this. But it was a Saturday, and there was no way to get around it. Through the mostly bare trees beyond the cross, Arvin could see wisps of smoke rising from a few chimneys half a mile away. 400 or so people lived in Knock 'em Stiff in 1957, nearly all of them connected by blood through one God-forsaken calamity or another, be it lust or necessity or just plain ignorance. Along with the tar-papered shacks and cinder-block houses, the holler included two general stores and a Church of Christ and Christian Union, and a joint known throughout the township as the Bullpen. Though the Russells had rented the house on top of the Mitchell Flats for 5 years now, most of the neighbors down below still considered them outsiders. Arvin was the only kid on the school bus who wasn't somebody's relation. 3 days before, he'd come home with another black eye. "I don't condone no fighting just for the hell of it, but sometimes you're just too easy going," Willard had told him that evening. "Them boys might be bigger than you, but the next time one of them starts his shit, I want you to finish it." Willard was standing on the porch changing out his work clothes. He handed Arvin the brown pants, stiff with dried blood and grease. He worked in a slaughterhouse in Greenfield, and that day 1,600 hogs had been butchered, a new record for R.J. Carroll meatpacking. Though the boy didn't know yet what he wanted to do when he grew up, he was pretty sure he didn't want to kill pigs for a living. They had just begun their prayers when the sharp crack of a branch breaking sounded behind them. As Arvin started to turn around, Willard reached over and stopped him, but not before the boy caught a glimpse of two hunters in the pale light, dirty and ragged men whom he'd seen a few times slouching in the front seat of an old sedan, scabbed with rust in the parking lot of Maud Speakman's store. One carried a brown burlap sack, the bottom stained a bright red. "Don't pay them no mind," Willard said quietly. "This here is the Lord's time, not nobody else's." Knowing that the men were close by made him nervous, but Arvin settled back down and closed his eyes. Willard considered the log as holy as any church built by man, and the last person in the world the boy wanted to offend was his father, even though that seemed like a losing battle at times. Except for the dampness dripping from the leaves and a squirrel cutting in a tree nearby, the woods were still again. Arvin was just beginning to think the men had moved on when one of them said in a raspy voice, "Hell, they having them a little revival meeting." "Keep it down," Arvin heard the other man say. "Shit, I'm thinking now would be a good time to pay his old lady a visit. She's probably laying over there in bed right now keeping it warm for me." "Shut the fuck up, Lucas," the other said. "What? Don't tell me you wouldn't take a piece of that. She's a looker, damned if she ain't." Arvin glanced over uneasily at his father. Willard's eyes remained shut, his big hands woven together on top of the log. His lips moved rapidly, but the words he said were too faint for anyone but the master to hear. The boy thought about what Willard had told him the other day, about standing up for yourself when someone gave you some shit. Evidently, those were just words, too. He had a sinking feeling that the long ride on the school bus was not going to get any better. "Come on, you dumb son of a bitch," the other man said. "This thing is getting heavy." Arvin listened as they turned and made their way back across the hill in the direction from which they'd come. Long after their footsteps faded away, he could still hear the mouthy one laughing. Okay, so I'm going to skip ahead to the end of this little piece. And what happens is Willard takes Arvin down in the Knock'em Stiff later on that day, and he finds the man who insulted his wife, and he gives him a beating. And so now he's getting back in the truck after beating the man, and Arvin's watched him do this. When he got back inside the pickup, Willard reached under the seat for a rag and wiped the traces of blood off his hands. "You remember what I told you the other day," he asked Arvin, "about them boys on the bus?" "Well, that's what I meant," Willard said, nodding over at the hunter. He tossed the rag out the window. "You just got to pick the right time." "Yes, sir," Arvin said. "There's a lot of no good son of bitches out there." "More than 100? Willard laughed a little and put the truck in gear. "Yeah, at least that many." He started to ease the clutch out. "I'm thinking it best if we keep this between us, okay? No sense getting your mom all upset." "No, she don't need that." "Good," Willard said. "Now how about I buy you a candy bar?" For a long time, Arvin would often think of that as the best day he ever spent with his father. After supper that evening, he followed Willard back over to the prayer log. The moon was rising by the time they got there, a sliver of ancient and pitted bone accompanied by a single shimmering star. They knelt down, and Arvin glanced over at his father's skinned knuckles. When she'd asked, Willard had told Charlotte that he'd hurt his hand changing a flat tire. Arvin had never heard his father lie before, but he felt certain that God would forgive him. In the still, darkening woods, the sounds traveling up the hill from the holler were especially clear that night. Down at the bullpen, the clanging of the horseshoes against the metal pegs sounded almost like church bells ringing, and the wild hoots and jeers of the drunks reminded the boy of the hunter lying bloody in the mud. His father had taught that man a lesson he'd never forget. And the next time somebody messed with him, Arvin was going to do the same. He closed his eyes and began to pray. Okay, so I'm going to skip ahead. Now, I've thrown just about everything but the kitchen sink into this book, all right? So there's Arvin and his family. There's a couple crazy preachers. There's a couple serial killers, corrupt sheriff, on and on. But what I'm going to do is read just a little bit of the beginning of part two, and I'm introducing the serial killers here. The couple had been roaming the Midwest for several weeks during the summer of 1965, always on the hunt. Two nobodies in a black Ford station wagon purchased for $100 at a used car lot in Meade, Ohio, called Brother Whitey's. It was the third vehicle they had gotten off the minister in as many years. The man on the passenger side was turned to fat and believed in signs and had a habit of picking his decayed teeth with a buck pocket knife. The woman always drove and wore tight shorts and flimsy blouses. They showed off her pale, bony body in a way they both thought enticing. She chain-smoked any kind of menthol cigarette she could get her hands on, while he chewed on cheap black cigars that he called dog dicks. The Ford burned oil and leaked brake fluid and threatened to spill its muddle guts all over the highway any time they pushed it past 50 miles an hour. The man liked to think that it looked like a hearse, but the woman preferred limousine. Their names were Carl and Sandy Henderson, but sometimes they had other names too. Over the past 4 years, Carl had come to believe that hitchhikers were the best, and there were plenty of them on the road in those days. He called Sandy the bait, and she called him the shooter, and they both called the hitchhikers the models. That very evening, just north of Hannibal, Missouri, they had tricked and tortured and killed a young enlisted man in a wooded area thick with humidity and mosquitoes. As soon as they picked him up, the boy had kindly offered them sticks of juicy fruit, said he'd drive for a while if the lady needed a break. "That'd be the goddamn day," Carl said. And Sandy rolled her eyes at the snide tone her husband sometimes used, as if he thought he was a better class of trash than the stuff they found along the roads. Whenever he got like that, she just wanted to stop the car and tell the poor fool in the back seat to get out while he still had a chance. One of these days, she promised herself, that was exactly what she was going to do. Hit the brakes and knock Mr. Big Shot down a notch or two. But not tonight. The boy in the back seat was blessed with a face smooth as butter and tiny brown freckles and strawberry-colored hair, and Sandy could never resist the ones who looked like angels. "What's your name, honey?" she asked him after they'd gone a mile or two down the highway. She made her voice nice and easy, and when the boy looked up and their eyes met in the rearview mirror, she winked and gave him the smile that Carl had taught her, the one he'd made her practice night after night at the kitchen table until her face was ready to fall off and stick to the floor like a pie crust, a smile that hinted at every dirty possibility a young man could ever imagine. Okay, so I'm going to skip ahead again. Okay, so, you know, they killed the soldier, and so the next few pages, they're, you know, we're in the scene with the army boy, and they get rid of the body, and they keep driving. And so they're headed home. So we'll start here. After driving through 100 miles of small, hushed towns and vast, dark cornfields, they came upon a rundown motel built out of pink cement blocks called the Sundowner. It was nearly 1 o'clock in the morning. Three cars sat in the potholed parking lot. Carl rang the buzzer several times before a light finally popped on inside the office, and an elderly lady with metal curlers in her hair opened the door crack and peered out. "That your wife in the car?" she asked, squinting past Carl at the station wagon. He looked around, could just barely make out the glow of Sandy's cigarette in the shadows. "You got good eyes," he said, managing a brief smile. "Yeah, that's her." "Where are you all from?" the woman said. Carl started to say Maryland, one of the few states he hadn't been to yet, but then remembered the tag on the front of the car. He figured the nosy old bag had already checked it out. "Up around Cleveland," he told her. The woman shook her head, pulled her house coat tighter around her. "You couldn't pay me to live in a place like that. All that robbing and killing going on." "You got that right," Carl said. "I worry all the time. Too many spooks for one thing. Heck, my wife won't hardly leave the house anymore." Then he pulled the army boy's money out of his pocket. "So how much for a room?" he asked. $6, the woman said. He wet his thumb and counted off some singles and handed them to her. She left for a moment and came back with a key on a worn and wrinkled cardboard tag. "Number 7, she said, "down on the end." The room was hot and stuffy and smelled like black flag. Sandy headed straight for the bathroom and Carl flipped the portable TV set on, though there wasn't anything on the air but snow and static that time of night. Not out here in the sticks, anyway. Kicking off his shoes, he started to pull down the thin plaid bedspread. 6 dead flies lay scattered on top of the flat pillows. He stared at them for a minute, then sat down on the edge of the bed and reached inside Sandy's purse for one of her cigarettes. He counted the flies again, but the number didn't change. Looking across the room, he rested his eyes on a cheap framed picture hanging on the wall, a flowers and fruit piece of shit that nobody would ever remember, not one person who ever slept in this stinking room. It served no purpose that he could think of, other than to remind a person that the world was a sorry-ass place to be stuck living in. He leaned forward and set his elbows on his knees, tried to imagine one of his pictures in its place. Maybe the beatnik from Wisconsin with the little cellophane of reefer. Or that big blonde bastard from last year, the one who put up such a fight. Of course, some were better than others. Even Carl would admit that. But one thing that he knew for certain, whoever looked at one of his photos, even one of the lousy ones from 3 or 4 years ago, they would never forget it. He'd bet the army boys a wad of greenbacks on that. He mashed the cigarette out in the ashtray and looked back down at the pillow. 6 was the number of models they had worked with this trip, and 6 was what the old bitch had charged him for the room. And now here were 6 poison flies lying in his bed. The lingering stench of the bug spray began to burn his eyes, and he dabbed at them with the end of the bedspread. "And what do these 3 sixes mean, Carl?" he asked himself out loud. Pulling out his knife, he fiddled with a hole in one of his molars while searching his mind for a suitable answer, one that avoided the most obvious implication of those 3 numbers, the biblical sign that his crazy old mother would have gleefully pointed out to him if she were still alive. "It means, Carl," he finally said, snapping his penknife shut, "that it's time to head home." And with a sweep of his hand, he brushed the tiny winged corpses off onto the red carpet. Dirty carpet, and flip the pillows over. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to be here with Donald and read with him and hear his work, which I find very moving. I struggle as he does. You like to think with a novel that the pieces of the novel are so brilliantly integrated and that you can't separate them, and the only way you can do a proper reading is to read from the beginning to the end, which will take about 17 or 18 hours, so I won't inflict that upon you. So you do end up leaping and jumping from piece to piece to try to give a flavor of the novel, and the voice of the novel, and maybe one or two of the characters that matter, and the world that they live in. So I'm going to do more or less the same thing that Donald did here. I'll read the first few pages of the novel, Lost Memory of Skin, it's called. And then I'll be jumping to try to fill out just that, not the story. The story is too complicated and too long and too elaborate and digressive, and there are too many other characters to ever possibly get this done in 15 or 20 minutes, but at least the flavor of it, perhaps. All right, this is how it begins. It isn't like the kid is locally famous for doing a good or a bad thing. And even if people knew his real name, it wouldn't change how they treat him unless they looked it up online, which is not something he wants to encourage. He himself, like most of the men living under the causeway, is legally prohibited from going online. But nonetheless, one afternoon, biking back from work at the Mirador, he strolls into the branch library down on Regis Road like he has every legal right to be there. The kid isn't sure how to get this done. He's never been inside a library before. The librarian is a fizzy lady, ginger-colored hair glowing around her head like a bug light, pink lipstick, freckles, wearing a floral print blouse and khaki slacks. She's a few inches taller than the kid, a small person above the waist, but wide in the hips like she'd be hard to tip over. The sign on the counter in front of her says, "Reference Librarian Gloria something." The kid is too nervous to register her last name. She smiles without showing her teeth and asks if she can help him. "Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I don't know, actually. What are you looking for?" "You're like the reference lady, right?" "Right. Do you need to look up something in particular?" "The air conditioning is cranked and the place feels about 10 degrees cooler now than it did when the kid came through the door, and he suddenly realizes he's shivering and thinks at first that it's the air conditioning. But the kid's not cold. He's scared. He's pretty sure he shouldn't be inside a public library, even though he can't remember there being any rules specifically against entering one as long as he's not loitering. And it's not a school library, and there's no playground or schools nearby. At least none that he's aware of. You can never be sure, though. Playgrounds and schools are pretty much lurking everywhere. And children and teenagers probably come in here all the time this late in the day to pretend they're doing homework or just to hang out." He looks around the large fluorescent-lit room, scans the long rows of floor-to-ceiling book-lined shelves. It's like a huge supermarket with nothing on the shelves but books. It smells like paper and glue, a little moldy and damp. Except for a geeky-looking black guy with glasses and a huge Adam's apple and big wind-catching ears sitting at a table with half a dozen thick books and no pictures open in front of him like he's trying to look up his ancestors, there's no other customers in the library. A customer. That's what he is. He's not here to ask this lady for a job or looking to rent an apartment from her, and he's not panhandling her. And he's for sure not going to hit on her. She's way too old, probably 40 or 50 at least, and pretty low on the hotness scale. No, the kid's a legitimate legal customer who strolled into the library to get some information, because libraries are where the information is. So why is he shaking and his arms all covered with goosebumps like he's standing naked inside a meat locker? It's not just because he's never actually been inside a library before, even when he was in high school and it was sort of required. He's shivering because he's afraid of the answer to the question that drove him here, even though he already knows it. "Listen, can I ask you something? It's kind of personal, I guess." "Of course." "Well, see, I live out in the North End, and the people in my neighborhood, my neighbors, they're all like telling me that there might be like a convicted sex offender living there in the neighborhood. And they tell me that you can just go online to this site that tells you where he's living and all, and they ask me if I check it out for them, for the neighborhood. Is it true? Is what true? You know, that you can just, like, go online and it'll tell you where the sex offender lives, even if you don't know his name or anything. Well, let's go see, she says, like he's wondering what's the capital of Vermont, and leads the kid across the room to a long table where six computers are lined up side by side and no one is using them. She sits down in front of one and does a quick Google search under convicted sex offenders, and up pops the National Sex Offender Registry, which links straight to www.familywatchdog.us. The kid stands at a forward tilt behind her, shifting his weight from one foot to the other. He thinks he should run now. Get out of here fast before she clicks again. But something he can't resist, something he knows is coming that is both scary and familiar, keeps him staring over the librarian's shoulder at the screen the same way he used to get held to the screen when cruising pornography sites. The librarian clicks, find offenders. And then off the new menu hits, by location. And another menu pops up and asks for the address. You're from Colusa, right? What's your neighborhood zip code? It's 33135. Any particular street you want to look up? He gives her the name of the street where his mother lives and he used to live, and she types it in and hits search. A pale green map of his street and the surrounding 20 or so blocks appears on the screen. Small red, green, and orange squares are scattered across the neighborhood like bits of confetti. Any particular block? The kid reaches down to the screen and touches the map on the block where he lived his entire life until he enlisted in the Army and where he lived again after he was discharged. A red piece of confetti covers his mother's bungalow in the backyard where he pitched his tent and built Iggy the Iguana's outdoor cage. The librarian clicks onto the tiny square, and suddenly the kid is looking at his mugshot, his forlorn, bewildered face. And he feels all over again the shame and humiliation of the night he was booked. There's his full name, first, last, and middle, date of birth, height, weight, his race, color of his eyes and hair, and the details of his crime and conviction. Slowly, the librarian turns in her chair and looks up at the kid's real face and then back at the computerized version. That's you, isn't it? I gotta go, he whispers. I gotta leave. He backs away from the woman, who appears both stunned and saddened, but not at all afraid, which surprises him, and for a few seconds he considers trying to explain how his face and his description and criminal record got there on the computer screen. But there's no way he can explain it to someone like her, a normal person, a lady reference librarian who helps people look up the whereabouts and crimes of people like him. Wait, don't leave. I gotta go. I'm sorry. No kidding. I'm really sorry. Don't be sorry. No, I'm probably not even supposed to be here, he says. In the library, I mean. He turns and walks stiff-legged away, and then as he nears the door, he breaks into a run, and the kid doesn't stop running until he's back up on his bike heading for the causeway. That's how it opens. And I'm going to leap to the causeway here so you have some sense of the world he's in. While he waits for the blue butane flame of his camp stove to heat his supper, The kid stands beside his tent in the damp semi-darkness beneath the Claiborne Causeway and contemplates the smooth blue waters of the wide Colusa Bay and the southern outflow of the thousand-mile-long Atlantic Intracoastal Waterway. Bumper-to-bumper cars, trucks, buses, and intermittent motorcycles rumble overhead, crossing between the mainland and the barrier isles on the eastern side of the bay. It's the end of a long, late summer day. Everyone's headed home. Everyone's home is in one place or the other. Not here, there, or over there. Definitely not here. Not here on the broad, flat, concrete peninsula that anchors the rusting steel piers that hold up the causeway. He pretends that he is alone down here. He turns away from the polyurethane lean-tos and tents and the salvaged plywood huts nearby and the men who live in them standing around like bored ghosts. And he gazes out at the bay, thinking not of where he is, but where he would like to be. This is how he has learned to endure being where he is, without bawling like a little lost boy, or worse, trying to escape from this place. He peers out at the bay. He tracks charter fishing boats and a few large white yachts and dozens of small private fishing and pleasure boats returning from open waters after a long day's pleasure at sea and in some cases work. He would like to be aboard one of those boats, a pleasure boat or a charter fishing boat or a shrimper. Any one of them would do, that one or that one. Or that 50-foot cabin cruiser shaped like an arrow. The flotilla passes through Kidd's Cut from the open sea into Colusa Bay and plows steadily northward, keeping downtown Colusa portside and the Great Barrier Isles off to starboard. Individual boats peel off and make their way to the thousands of marinas, dockyards, piers, and slips scattered along the mainland, and the islets and canals that filigree both the mainland side of the bay and the barriers where the fleet finally disintegrates. The kid listens to the rumble and roar overhead of day's end traffic crossing the Claiborne Causeway, and trying to hear his thoughts, he turns and looks south across the lower bay at the clustered skyscrapers of downtown Colusa, 50-story towers of smoked glass and gleaming sheets of aluminum and steel high-rise hotels, Marriotts and Hyatts and Holiday Inns built for business travelers. There are domed convention centers and international banking and insurance company office buildings and whole colonies of condominiums stacked on top of one another like gigantic poker chips. A condo downtown would be fine, he thinks. He doesn't need to live on the barriers. Even a small studio on a low floor without a view would do. He'd furnish it simply for one person alone with a single bed and a table and two chairs and a lamp or two and a dresser. Maybe a few small pictures. Some dishes and pots and pans. Sheets and blankets and towels. Keep it simple. Keep it neat and clean. He doesn't really require a view, but it would be nice to have one, to stroll to the fridge and take out a frosty Corona and crack it open and flop in his lazy boy recliner and check out the city below. At this time of day, he'd watch the glass and metal towers cast their long shadows over the cluttered port where cranes and gigantic elevators load and offload rows of room-sized steel shipping containers from wheezing freighters headed to or from China, India, and Brazil. He'd consider the three creamy cruise ships lined up like floating amusement parks beside the docks and warehouses, sleepily waiting to be restocked with food and liquor and refilled with fresh island-hopping, limbo-dancing tourists from the north. If the kid were a deckhand, he'd have his own bunk in one of those ships. He'd have access to a galley where the cook prepares meals and the crew eats them. A recreation room for watching TV and movies on DVD. He'd be able to travel to Asia or South America or to the islands of the Caribbean. Out where the sprawling city dwindles and finally ends, beyond where the malls and bungalows and gated communities of the suburbs turn into trailer parks, and the trailer parks eventually merge with palmetto scrub and cane fields and mangrove marsh, out beyond the great Pensacola swamp, a flattened red sun glimmers near the low, unbroken horizon. Streaked with tangerine strips of cloud, the western sky turns turquoise and then orange all over and finally scarlet. The kid can see that evening sky from here beneath the causeway, but only if he walks out to the end of the concrete peninsula and stands at the water's lapping edge and looks up. A pair of 747s departs simultaneously from the International Airport west of downtown. Parallel white contours scratch the darkening sky. Then directly overhead, one plane slowly veers northeast in a long arc toward England, while the other bisects the dark sky above the black and green Gulf Stream on a line that follows the Tropic of Cancer straight east all the way to North Africa. And beyond, here below the causeway, he gazes along the smaller Great Barrier Isles and the canals between them and the bayside backsides of the palatial homes of singers, professional athletes, and movie stars, and the men and women who import and export drugs and manage and launder other people's ill-gotten and sometimes inherited money and hedge funds and offshore accounts in the Caymans, Turks, and Caicos and Bahamas. Along the canals, the mostly Moorish-style estates hide floodlit manicured gardens, terraces, and Olympic-sized pools behind 10-foot walls alarmed and topped with razor wire. Looking east beyond them, he can see the tall seaside hotels, their pastel walls splashed with warm light. Neon signs chum the names of the hotels against the purple eastern sky and block out the stars. Conquistador, Casa Calusa, Montague, Mirador. The cars, buses, and trucks on the causeway and bridges and the north-south interstate and the traffic-jammed turnpikes to the suburbs have switched their headlights on. In the high-rises and skyscrapers downtown, fluorescent nightlights ignite floor after floor as the cleaners and janitors and watchmen begin their night's work. And from the rooftops and penthouses, slender beacons reach like long pale arms into the darkness. An offshore breeze puts a sudden chill in the air. Night has fallen in the city of Calusa and along the Great Barrier Isles and down here under the wide, loud causeway that connects the two. And then I'll jump to the near the end to one short paragraph which kind of gives you a slight overview. The kid is attached to anklet, an electronic anklet with a GPS. And he's charging his battery here at this point. And this kind of gives you a sense of his larger community, if you will. It takes half an hour to fully charge his monitor battery. And during that half hour, the kid feels intimately connected to the millions of other convicted sex offenders, young and old and in between, rapists and child abusers and men who expose their genitals on a bus, public masturbators, voyeurs and escalator gropers, compulsive seducers of teenage boys, coaches who couldn't keep their hands off their athletes, men who talk dirty in internet chat rooms to people they thought were teenage girls and then arranged to meet them for sex. fathers and uncles who drunkenly reached out for their teenage daughters as they passed by the sofa. Porn addicts and fantasists lost in the misty zone between reality and imagery, no longer able to tell the difference. All of whom, at this moment, have plugged their electronic shackles into outlets and are sitting in the bedrooms, living rooms, and basements of houses and apartments and mobile homes, in garages, homeless shelters, public parks, in airports and train stations, in waiting rooms, offices, and the back rooms of fast food restaurants, and under causeways and overpasses, as if they were all trembling leaves on the branches, large and small, of a vast electrical tree that casts its shadow across the entire country. I'll end there.
Terrific readings. I had a critic the other day describe to me, he said, reading the book was like reading the notes, and then when you hear the author read, it's like hearing the music. I think there's a difference. If you gentlemen would pull the microphones in, folks, raise your hands. Okay. If you'd like to start us off with a question, we'll get a mic to you. On our left, fellow about six rows back.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Banks.
Where are you for a second?
Right here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, good. Thank you.
And I'm a great fan of Cloud Splitter, and I wanted to ask if you could discuss the problems that an author faces in writing a novel about an actual historical character.
Thanks. I'm sure you did. You all hear the question, okay? I don't have to repeat it. Okay, good. I've done it a number of times. I mean, that is the most obvious because it concerns John Brown, the abolitionist and terrorist, and he of Harper's Ferry, et cetera. But I also have done it in a book called The Darling with regard to the Liberian Civil War in the 1990s, and Charles Taylor is a major character. He who sits in the dock today at The Hague. And so I've done it, and actually in other books too, now that I think of it. But basically, it's not a problem for me. I'm simply invoking iconic figures that I know already exist in the imagination of the reader and in my imagination. And as long as I adhere to the historical record with regard to that person, I don't feel any violation of certainly of privacy. But the need for me is mainly to adhere to the historical record in as much as that affects the question of plausibility. I mean, there are things about Brown's life which are not known, and I invented great pieces of it and put it into the book in Cloud Splitter. He never, for instance, went to the Charles Street Meeting House in Boston, Massachusetts, and heard Ralph Waldo Emerson deliver his talk on his essay and talk on heroism. I wanted Brown to hear that speech, that talk, because I wanted Brown to identify with Emerson's call for heroic figure and to feel that it was really about himself. And also, in some way, also to reject Emerson's particular form of abolitionism. So I invented it. Biographers and historians tend to be a little bit more, tend to be sort of critical of this liberal freedom that I feel. But this is a tradition in storytelling. I mean, this is pre-Homeric in a sense. Every storyteller, since Homer and on, has felt comfortable enough with historical and iconic figures like that to invoke them, whether Che Guevara or Thomas Jefferson or John Brown or Charles Taylor even. So I've never had a particular problem with it. But I think many writers also feel similarly. I mean, E.L. Doctorow certainly seems to have no problem with it. There are many other writers. Well, Shakespeare didn't seem to have a problem with it. So I didn't feel particularly anxious about it.
Good company. Lady in the fifth row there.
Hello. I wondered, The Sweet Hereafter was a marvelous book and also a wonderful movie. Could you explain a little about the experience of having a book made into a movie? It is not always the case that a good book, you know, becomes a good movie, and I wondered what your experience was.
True. It's actually usually not the case, and I felt very fortunate, of course, that transition from novel to film went as smoothly as it did, and turned into a very elegant and lovely movie that I thought captured the mood and the central themes of the novel as effectively as it did. I was very lucky, but I was working with a kind of auteur filmmaker, Adam Agoyan, whose work I trusted, his previous work I had seen and knew and trusted. And so I was just really eager to see what he would make of this material. I knew enough about the process of adaptation by then to realize that what happens when a filmmaker decides to adapt a novel to film, what they basically do is smash the film on the novel on the floor and then pick out of the pieces, the few pieces that might make a good movie. And you hope that they will be artistically interesting and that in fact it'll be an artistically interesting movie and that they will be able to accomplish something that you would like to see just as a moviegoer. And that happened all the way down the line. It was actually in many ways even more satisfying because Adam was a brilliant director and screenwriter, and he invited me into the process, and I got to play with it and learn a great deal quickly. I did the same thing with Paul Schrader in Affliction. I had a kind of crash course in filmmaking with these two men, and because they were so generous and sweet about inviting me into the process, and not as a controlling figure by any means, but just as a collaborator. And I learned a great deal, and it allowed me to think that maybe I could be even more involved in the process as I go along, and I have become, as a result, more involved in film making an adaptation of my own books and others as well. But I was happy with it. There are a couple of scenes in there that make me squirm, but it's collaborative and no one's quite in control. That's the most interesting thing about filmmaking when you realize once you get into it is that nobody's in charge here. It really is collaborative. If you're a novelist, and you know you're the only one, you know you're all by yourself. You're in charge of everything, and if they're going to blame anybody, they're going to blame you for everything. And you can't blame the cinematographer, the writer, the director, the actors, or anybody else. And so there are bound to be places where you just cringe, as I did. But it wasn't because they weren't loyal to the novel. I cringed because it wasn't. They were glitches, as I saw it, in the movie, as a movie.
I wonder if we could address an issue that we were talking about earlier, and that is class in literature, which is sort of one reason that these two gentlemen are on stage together. And you were talking about nobody reads Dos Passos anymore, and we were talking earlier about Donald Woodrell. Is that his name? Wintersbone?
Woodrow,
yeah. Yes. And I'm wondering if you think that's just become passé or more of the writers writing today have different concerns, a focus on sort of the urban, which is not necessarily the urban poor, unlike your rural poor and your urban sort of preterite is the old word for it.
Mm. Don, you want to address that?
Well, as far as my own work goes, I think that I wasn't really, you know, intentionally focusing on, you know, the lower classes or whatever. It's just the world that I knew better than any other. So It's the one that I, you know, have ended up writing about. Somebody had asked me that question a few weeks ago about, well, you know, do you think this is a, there's a, another trend coming around where writers are focusing more on class? And I don't really know if there is or not. I'm hoping, though, that maybe with what's happening on Wall Street right now, you know, maybe the 99% will you start wanting those kinds of stories again. You know, but like I said, as far as my own stuff goes, it's just pretty much, you know, the world that I know.
You do write from what you know, and I certainly have as well to a large degree, but you also adhere at some point, I think, greater or lesser degree consciously, to a tradition. There are certain writers that you attach yourself to in of the past and,
yes.
And so on. You say, oh, that writer excites me, then that work, even 19th century, 18th century, however far back you want to go, excites me. And often it turns out to be a writer who's not in fashion at the moment or is outside the usual cast of the canon. And I've always argued that, you know, there are really two very powerful strains in American fiction, and one is what evolved out of let's say Hawthorne to Henry James to modernism in a way, and a kind of aesthetically pure and beautiful kind of storytelling. And then there's this other rough-hewn tradition that really evolves out of Twain, Stephen Crane, and into the 20th century, Theodore Dreiser, and I was speaking earlier about Nelson Algren, who had been an important mm-hmm. factor, and Richard Wright, and so on. And there are these two, it's kind of a dialectical relation between these two kinds of not writing really, but approaches to the problem of the mystery of writing fiction. And I know that as a young writer, and I suspect that's true of you too, Don, and that I adhered more quickly and more easily to writers who came out of that rough-hewn vernacular American tradition where I felt most comfortable. And, you know, it takes odd forms. I mean, I even would include in that, you know, Jack Kerouac's On the Road and a lot of peculiar books that people might not see in those terms, but that I sort of did. And I thought Kerouac was more like Dreiser than he was like Hemingway and, or as he was hoping, like Proust. You know, it's a rough-hewed story about an immigrant kid who's trying to make invent himself as a writer and intellectual, you know, despite all. And so this is a tradition that I think, you know, that also motivates, besides your own personal experience and your own origins and what you know best and the people you developed your earliest sympathies for. There's also when you become a writer and you're an adult now and you're, you know, I'm inventing myself as an intellectual and a writer in the larger world, you do adhere to a tradition and you hope to identify it and claim it as your own. And I've done that. And I think that we're going through a period right now where that's a tradition somewhat in abeyance and not particularly easy to for younger writers to claim. I mean, for instance, John Dos Passos is not taught in universities at all. He's off the syllabus. Nelson Algren is out of print. Many writers of this ilk simply are not taught in universities. And when that happens, then the younger writers, the younger, you know, intellectual students, et cetera, people who are trying to figure out how to write and what to do with their creative energies and all, don't have access to those works and that tradition. And so whenever I have an opportunity, as I have just taken, to remind us that there's a very powerful tradition of vernacular American writing. And in fact, it may be central. I like to think that. As Hemingway pointed out, you know, when he said that Huckleberry Finn is the fountainhead, the origin of all American storytelling. Well, he was talking about a homeless kid who was probably drug-addled or would be today, who was abused by his father. who crossed all the moral codes of the time and made it into the great mythic story of the American imagination.
But when you're talking about rough-hewn, you're talking about content rather than the quality of the craft that goes into creating.
Oh, yeah. I'm also talking about language, however. Don't forget, I mean, the passages that you read tonight, the passages I read tonight, are very much in the American vernacular, the spoken speech of American people, and not the spoken speech necessarily of certainly not of business people and the financial industry and Wall Street, and certainly not of academics. It's the spoken speech of ordinary people. And this is the great gift of the novel. The gift of the novel for me, and I'm sorry to go on so long here, but I just wanted to make one more point a little further, is the most democratic form. Because what it does is it gives meaning to the subjective lives of people we would ordinarily not pay any attention to. I mean, it begins with Cervantes and comes forward, and that's all it does. And it does it better than any other art form that we have access to. And the American novel is particularly good at this. And this is where the envy, I mean, people don't realize this, even because this, members of the Nobel Prize Committee sometimes complain about the provinciality of American writers. Yet, writers and readers all over the world envy American novelists because they give voice to ordinary people in a way that no other novelists do.
Thanks. A few more questions? Oh, we're not done yet. We've got some more questions. Lady in the yellow on the aisle. Sorry, I can't see if you're a lady or not because somebody's blocking you.
Sorry, I went on so long there.
I read with interest the New York Times review of your book this weekend. And one of the things that struck me was they're acknowledging how you seem to create a balance between being empathic towards the kid and also not excusing his behaviors. And so I have two questions. One is, was it difficult to do that? And the second is, have you received any kind of flack for choosing this as a topic?
It wasn't difficult for me as a writing the book to attach myself to a character like the kid, who is guilty, clearly guilty. He broke the law, and the law won. He crossed the line. He's not a serial rapist. He's not a pedophile, but he did cross a line, and no question about it. And but he's also ashamed. And the dialectic between guilt and shame is part of the novel and how he deals with that. And he's ashamed because he's internalized society's view of him as a convicted sex offender. His shame arises from that. All shame, in a sense, does by internalizing society's view of yourself. But guilt, he's certainly there. And I understood that fairly early on, that I had to deal with that, that I had to make him accept, as he does, his guilt and deal with the question of shame. We all have committed, not necessarily crimes, but offenses. We're all guilty and of something. But we don't have to feel ashamed for everything, for our offenses, necessarily. And so I was struggling with that. That's sort of the moral center of the novel in a real way, I guess. So I never had a problem with that or worrying about it. But in answer to the second part of your question, I have run into I won't call them by any means attacks, but they were outright rejections of the novel without having read the novel. I did a few radio call-in interviews in the West Coast last week, and a few people called in who began by describing themselves as having been abused as children sexually, and accused me of blaming the victim and excusing the perpetrator, and there's really very little one can respond, very few ways one can respond to that kind of anger and hurt, except to acknowledge the anger and the hurt and to legitimize it, certainly, but also then to say that, no, the novel's really not about that. and it doesn't disregard or diminish the suffering, the pain, the lifelong, in many cases, trauma that a person who has been sexually abused as a child or adolescent endures. It's merely trying to humanize people that we dehumanize. I'll be the first to admit there are characters in this novel that I could not get close to personally. And they remain minor characters. They lurk in the background like shadows and ghosts. Sociopathic pedophiles who have no sense of guilt or responsibility and no insight into the feelings of the victims or the human beings that they molested. And there are a couple of characters like that. And they stand out in a way. They're very differentiated from the kid and from a few other characters as well. I couldn't go there. And I confess that. Maybe for some future novel, if I'm brave enough, I might try it. But I couldn't go there in this novel. So all I ask of a reader who feels, given the subject matter and given the characters who are characters we have decided are like trolls living under a bridge in our society, and that they read the novel. And for the first thing, and then I'd be perfectly willing to listen to any kind of criticism.
Well, for now, we'll have to leave it under the bridge. Please join me in thanking Russell Banks and Donald Ray Pollard.
Right off stage.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.